Welcome back to Forging Worlds. I'm Matt.
And I'm Alan.
And we're back with a downtime building blocks episode, aren't we?
Yes, we are. And I'm pretty excited about this topic. You brought it up to me a little while ago. And, you know, it's very crunchy and very interesting. And I think we can do a lot of things with it. So why don't you tell the good people what we're talking about today?
So this was back in February, I believe, is when this all happened. I was watching the Olympics opening ceremony this year with some friends of mine, and I noticed some weird things. And I messaged Alan and said, hey, I've got an idea for a downtime conversation for Forging Worlds. The Olympic opening ceremony as a ritual summons, or like as a massive ritual. I don't want to constrain us to a summons.
Okay, everybody, put on your tinfoil hats, because here we go.
Now, let's start off and say I was watching the 2018 Winter Olympics from Pyongyang, South Korea.
What he's saying is that he didn't watch the 2012 opening ceremony, which is one of my personal favorites, that involves Voldemort, Mary Poppins, and James Bond.
I was trying to provide some context for the immediacy of what prompted the idea, but sure. So I want to lay a couple little groundwork things here. First of all, if you have not watched Olympic opening ceremonies, I'm not sure you're on planet Earth.
Or at least are passingly familiar with the pomp and pageantry that comes with the Olympic opening ceremony.
I mean, they're on YouTube. You should really go watch some. They're very good.
They're very good. They're very interesting. And most of all, they're pretty bizarre for the most part.
Oh, yeah. And these especially, because they incorporated some like AR elements that only TV viewers could see. They had choreographed drone swarms, Alan. Mm-hmm. Choreographed drone swarms.
You know who else did? Lady Gaga at the halftime show. For a Super Bowl.
I don't watch sports.
I don't either, but that was a good performance.
If you say so. I also don't particularly watch people who dress up in meat dresses, so.
She's moved past that. Check out her version of The Sound of Music from the Grammys.
But I don't like The Sound of Music.
She sang it in the original key that Julie Andrews sang it, and Julie Andrews was so impressed that she, gave her super duper kudos. Like, it was a big deal. Just saying.
Okay. So, back to the Olympics.
I want Julie Andrews to be my grandmother. But back to the Olympics.
I just claim it. No one's going to contradict you. So, the Olympics. This year's, the specific one, let's start off with some very overt things that were kind of ritualistic. The opening stadium is a pentagram, or a pentagon.
Mm-hmm.
We're not going to get necessarily into the full tinfoil hat of it's a pentagram, but, you know. It, that's there.
Did they make a star shape at any point?
I'm sure they did.
Oh, and also, listeners, please do forgive us. For example, just to kind of look, I pulled up the complete London 2012 opening ceremony. It is literally 4 hours long. So there is a lot here to dig through. So a lot of this is going to also kind of be playing on what we remember and kind of what is iconic about a lot of these opening ceremonies.
Exactly. And this is also, again, we're going to embellish where we need to embellish. So after we get done some preliminaries, do remember, we're not talking facts here. If you happen to live in a world that's getting this podcast where ceremonies like this are rituals and do make magic happen, if you could send me an invite, I'd love to move there.
Please. That email is forgingworlds@fifthdraw.com.
Yes.
Just shoot us an email.
Yes, please. We both would like to move. Secondly, and this is a very, very, very obvious thing, there is, in every single Olympic ceremonies ever of all time, a giant ritually lit flame.
Yep. Sometimes many flames, but always the torch.
Yeah. And, I mean, the torch might not be something you directly want to play with because there's a lot of history involved with that. And, You don't want to risk waking something up on Mount Olympus if you don't have to. So,
I'm sorry. I think you just struck upon what one of my things was going to be. Thanks.
Well, our brains work in very similar ways. So, sorry. Listen,
I also can still
play with that. It's fine.
I also think that we are forgetting another major part of these opening ceremonies in giant air quotes rituals. The use of children. Almost every single opening ceremony. So, for example, in the London one, there's a children's choir. You had mentioned that there were five children dressed in the Power Rangers primary colors running around that were kind of the through line of the story. Children are involved almost every single time. What else are children typically involved in? Rituals, because of innocence.
Yep. There's also, and this is I feel like, an important point. The Olympics, historically, are a time of kind of globally enforced peace.
Mm-hmm.
In theory, that's kind of the theory. Is one of the founding principles of the Olympics was all war was to stop when they were held. Now, that's more in line with the ancient Greeks. Probably not so much nowadays. But the Olympics are intended to be a time of peace, which can also translate to the Olympics are a time when people's guards are down.
Mm-hmm.
So if you take innocence and symbolism and people being potentially caught off guard, you've got a potent brew. So let's just dive in. I think we're going to unpack a lot of the details in our own.
I've got one more general thing that I feel is important to understand about not just the opening ceremony, but the Olympics in general.
Okay.
Listener, you may be thinking to yourself, Alan, Matt, you're not talking Hello. About blood. Blood is usually a very important rite in a lot of different rituals, especially when summoning creatures from the dark beyond.
It's true. Go on.
When you watch the Olympics, tell me the next time you watch hockey, or boxing, or any number of contact sports that have become a part of the Olympics over the years, and tell me no one bleeds during those events.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, the entire... This could easily be conflated to it's not just the opening ceremonies that are a ritual, but that the entire Olympics are a ritual that begin with the opening and end with the closing.
Exactly, because the closing ceremony is just as pomp and circumstance as the opening.
Mm-hmm.
And what better gift to give whatever you're trying to summon than the energy, talent, and power of the world's greatest athletes?
It's true. All right, let's dive in. Alan, it sounds like you have several ideas, so spin me off one of those.
One of them is that the Olympics held, let's say, in Greece, the next time that it's held, you know, not necessarily in Athens, but in Greece somewhere, the torch lighting accidentally wakes up Hephaestus.
Why Hephaestus specifically?
The forge. So the torch that they get and the metal that they use to create the torch actually came from Hephaestus's forge. So lighting the torch reignites his forge, which wakes him up.
Okay. Besides the slightly obvious point of a actual little g god wandering around is probably not great for the world, why is Hephaestus a bad thing? He's typically not one of the more malevolent ones.
Because what's the first thing you think he's going to do? Wake up his wife?
Find Ares and kick his ass again?
That, but more likely, wake up his wife.
Yeah, we don't need her running around.
What?
That's probably
you're
not
okay
great.
With Aphrodite running around?
You mean one of the actual primeval forces of the universe, given human form?
Uh-huh.
No, not especially.
So Hephaestus wakes up Aphrodite, who looks at the world and decides, you know, there's not enough love here.
Yeah, that's exactly kind of her deal. That would not be great.
Nope.
Well, and see, here's the other problem following that line of thought. Aphrodite thinks Hephaestus and immediately goes and wakes up Ares.
Who immediately goes and wakes up most of the rest of the gods, not on purpose, but because he's making so much noise.
because he's a fucking idiot. Yeah.
And so Athena has to come along, and she gets woken up, and they basically have to assemble, kind of, it basically becomes a godly war with humanity in the middle. You're welcome.
That's terrifying. I don't like it. That's very bad for all of us.
Oh, and here's the best part about all of that. You think there's going to be like a savior that rises up? Nope. All the saviors are dead. There are no demigods left. So it's literally gods and mortals kind of don't stand a chance against a god.
And, you know, if you wanted to make this into a longer running campaign, or if you just really wanted to mess with some players.
I have an answer to that, too. But go ahead.
You could easily say that when one pantheon wakes up, the rest start to wake up.
Mm-hmm.
And let me tell you a real true story about this day and age. We could probably handle having the Egyptian gods running amok because, you know, they're whatever. But if the Norse gods woke up, we're probably all done boned. So maybe no thank you.
So do we also want to go ahead and talk about what system I would like to run this in?
Yeah.
So there's a system, and I don't know if I've mentioned it on Forging Worlds before, but it's one that I wouldn't call it new necessarily. I think it came out like 2012, but it's called The End of the World.
Aha, yes.
And there are lots of flavors. You have End of the World Aliens, End of the World... like
zombies,
End of the World, whatever. My personal Cthulhu. Favorite is End of the World, the Gods. And the purpose of End of the World is you play yourself, and the game starts as you sit down to play a game of the End of the World. So let's say, for example, I had run a Cthulhu game in this. So it was basically the players... after you create yourself on a character sheet, which that character creation process is actually very cool, you sit down, and I was basically like, all right, so you guys sit down to play, and all of a sudden all your phones start going off, that there's been this huge tidal wave that destroyed half of downtown Mobile. What do you do?
Hmm.
I think that could be a very interesting thing to do here with everyday people trying to survive in this deific war.
I dig it. I dig that a lot.
So what would you do? What is your first pitch?
Well, my first pitch is going to be kind of the basic one that I thought of when I was watching the winter ceremonies this year. So this is, of course, this year was in South Korea. And they had this big kind of feature going around of these kids talking to these mythic beasts and exploring the history of Korea, all that kind of, that's called kind of traditionally Olympic opening ceremonies fodder. But then they had this giant ring rise up out of the ground with lights attached to it. So it made this glowing column that people were kneeling around, and the imagery depicted in it was supposed to be like future tech kind of stuff. So it was like the Matrix code was flowing up and down this thing.
Interesting.
But what it looked like was almost like a knowledge upload of some sort.
Interesting.
So here's my pitch. The Olympics have been since the beginning meant to contain a super intelligent computer entity. So some ancient civilization computer entity of some sort, like some ancient supercomputer, give it some sort of nanite replication thing, and has been sealed. And the constant Olympic ceremony with all its pomp and circumstance and the lighting of the torch and everything are all meant to continue to keep its prison sealed. Except this time, someone inserted some new information into the ceremony, gave it a massive knowledge dump, and allowed it to circumvent the system.
Interesting. Mm. So what threat does this system cause what threat does this system present to humanity?
Well, this thing is absolutely a colony machine. It was sent here to terraform Earth because all that was there when it was dispatched was just some primitive bipeds that were barely out of the trees. It's fun. The universe is better off without them. So they're worth the sacrifice to preserve this alien machine's home world. So it came here to terraform Earth to match its original world and to then repopulate it.
Okay. Interesting. What is it repopulated? Like, what are they?
I don't know. And I'm not entirely sure that it matters.
True.
It's one of those, like the unseen might be more terrifying than the original kind of deal.
That's like, also than very specifying fair. It.
Yeah. And it's also, there's also no way of guaranteeing that all this time being stuck underneath a containment ritual, I said that really weird, stuck underneath a containment ritual hasn't warped it so that what it would produce is not what it was meant to produce.
Hmm.
Interesting. Because again, you have just centuries of humanity pouring out their blood, sweat, and tears in this massive ritual ceremony. Who's to say it's not absorbing that?
Mm, so would it? So it has developed some form of sapience, but this gave it sentience, maybe?
No, I think what it is that it was always sentient. It has to be to execute this program. It may not have free will, but what it's done is it's been corrupted and driven a little bit insane. So we kind of have like a system shock or a... almost like a
portal situation, GLaDOS.
Yeah, portal, or if you're familiar with some old Bungie games, Marathon, where the Durandal AI just goes right off the rails.
The Stanley Parable?
Also that, yeah.
Interesting.
So that's just this constant battering that this like psychic human concentrated will has done to it has just hopelessly warped it. So now it's just like, all right, we're all y'all gonna burn, and then I'll pick up the pieces later.
So I just had a very silly thought, but before I get there, what would you run this in?
I have two options. One, there's a Savage Worlds supplement setting thing. It's called The Day After Ragnarok. And you play people in a post-Ragnarok world. With a little bit of retooling, you could easily make all of that into a post-Grey Goo world. Very little effort. So that'd be my first choice if you wanted to do in the immediate aftermath. Otherwise, you have this super sentient computer that's just like, oh, it's my time, and it wins, and humanity is put into bunkers, and you just run it as paranoia.
I was going to say paranoia, that the thing just becomes friend computer.
Yes, friend computer, that is a wonderful idea. Thank you.
For any of our listeners that are intrigued about paranoia, don't be. You don't have the security clearance.
Yeah, you're not cleared to know. And you can't ask us questions or friend computer will become unhappy.
And incinerate you. But don't worry, you have clones.
However, curiosity is a communist offense. Man, paranoia is just so good.
And so silly, and I love it.
If you want to play paranoia, you absolutely should. You cannot go into that game thinking that it is a real role-playing game.
Nope.
You don't get to take that game seriously.
No, not at all.
Oh, man. So that's my first. So, Alan, what do you have? Do you have another one in there?
Mine is something similar to the supercomputer, but to me, ultimately very, very different.
Okay.
I think, anyway.
All right.
The Olympics are a bastion of emotion.
Uh-huh.
You have triumph, you have despair, you have frustration, anger. If the World Health Organization study on STDs at the Olympics is any indication, lust, like just overflowing with emotions at these Olympic Games. What if the emotions become a gestalt entity?
Ooh.
Well, that's a creature of raw emotion. No logic, only feeling.
So you get something like one of those like core entities from the Green Lantern universe?
Kind of. But it doesn't even have to inherently be bad or be evil, but it's an accident. And its birth and its creation is resplendent and terrifying, and it is resplendent and terrified because all it knows is base emotion. So one of the first things it feels is fear, you know, but just creating this gestalt emotional golem almost.
Okay. So what system would you run this in?
That gets tricky.
Yeah.
There's
not a lot that's really cut out to handle this.
No, not at all. Which makes me think Genesis or Fate. Okay. Just kind of to take the easy way. But what I think could happen is that the creation of this gestalt entity also unlocks certain manipulations to the fabric of reality. So manifesting emotion as power. So that is getting kind of Green Lantern-y, but, you know.
If you did that, though, you could easily then just kind of quickly hack a superhero game.
Mm-hmm.
Or even a like D20 modern kind of magic game.
Mm-hmm.
Like you could probably repurpose a lot of the Dresden Files stuff for that.
Yep, exactly. So, but yeah.
All right, that's pretty good.
What about you? What's your second pitch?
Okay, so this one, you're this near an ocean. You've got a big ritual hidden in plain sight.
You thought we weren't going to go to Cthulhu, listeners, but I knew Matt and I wasn't going to take it from him.
I don't know why y'all even assumed that. It's a massive ritual. Come on. This is going to summon something Lovecraftian. Now, I don't want to do Cthulhu, because Cthulhu, that poor squid-faced wingeding boy, has been done to death.
Can it be Yogg-Sothoth?
Yeah, sure, why not?
He is the gate. He is the future, the present, and the past. He is also the key.
Which seems complicated, but, you know, when you're a giant flying spaghetti monster in the center of reality, it's allowed.
Mm-hmm. So tell me more about this, the summoning of this eldritch horror.
Well, see, here's the thing. I don't think it was ever intended. Okay. In fact, what I think happens is you have several competing organizations that their oracles or scryers, whatever, where it's like, hey, something big is going to go down at the Olympics, and this is going to be an opportunity for us to get in on this. We can gain ourselves some more power. We can accomplish some more stuff.
Ooh.
So all of them kind of independently of each other inserted elements into the opening ceremonies designed to turn this into a ritual for their benefit. And that compound effect just rips things open.
Okay. So what role would your players be taking?
Okay. Well, that kind of depends, because there's two ways you can do this. Again, I'm kind of cheating here, but there's two ways you can do it. Neither of these answers are going to be silly answers like paranoia. So the first route is you take the one of those Delta Green games. If you're not familiar with Delta Green, they're like the CIA's undercover black bag anti-mythos team.
I was just thinking something very similar to this, but go ahead.
They're usually like rogue operatives who are kind of torn between their oath to America and their stated goal of staving off these threats from outside reality. So it's a nice little like drama system kind of deal. It's not actually the drama system. It's built on the gumshoe system. It's very, very interesting. It's very good. I think you could have them in the aftermath of this trying to salvage things.
Okay.
So again, a little bit not post-apocalyptic, maybe peri-apocalyptic.
Mm-hmm.
So that, you know, this thing, you start off where your players have been assigned to the opening ceremonies to guard this dignitary. This dignitary knows more than they're letting on, so you get to question him about stuff. And he's eventually just like, yeah, Majestic is over there. They're doing some shit. You need to stop them. everything happens, and, you know, an elder being of some sort, you know, Yogg-Sothoth, Dagon, if you want to be predictable, Cthulhu, Nyarlathotep, anything you want to have happen just suddenly just like bamfs into reality in the middle of this, and they have to stop it and evacuate people and try to stave off more devastation, and it's just a nice hopeless spiral. So that's one option. Second option is you have this be a the opening ceremonies is a far distant point. And you use Knight's Black Agents to go in where you're this mercenary crew who's been hired by one of these companies to go destabilize the ritual effort of another company.
Nice.
And once you catch wind that they're doing this and that your original employer's doing this, you start getting to be able to find all these other pieces, and you have to like cut deals with people and choose which of these are okay to be in there, because there's probably like a certain threshold where if you get under that threshold, yeah, nothing bad's going to happen. They'll just get their ritual power-ups. If it's above that threshold, kaboom.
Very nice.
So that gives you kind of like a little bit of a Mass Effect ticking clock where you have to have galactic readiness and all that crap. That gives you that kind of feeling, which I think could be a lot of fun for this.
I have a third option for it. Well, actually two other options for you.
Hit it.
One, if you want to take it in a goofier direction, the Knight's Black Agent, there is a system that I think could easily be hacked for this called Satanic Panic. The system is designed about government agents that go in and stop D&D players from actually summoning demons. So you just scale it up.
Yeah.
So you're these agents that go in to stop the summoning of this creature.
Very
the
good.
Other way yeah. to do it is you play the cultists.
Oh.
And you're trying to make this happen, and you have to infiltrate into the opening ceremony and into all of these places. And I can't remember the name of the system. She's a super geek, did a really good episode on it. But essentially, the longer you go, the more cracked you become. So it gets harder for you to blend in with normal people.
Okay.
And eventually, like, you'll get found out. I cannot remember the name of it. So after some dedicated Googling, Matt has found that the name of the game that I was trying to think of is Soth, where you play cultists trying to summon a dark god. If you complete three or more rituals, Soth will arise. But can you conceal your intentions from others? So it's this fun kind of campy game that I think would be very interesting to play.
That sounds good. I dig that. That could be a lot of fun. So there's also, I guess, just you could have this ritual be anything.
Literally, right? Anything.
Like, it doesn't, even the ideas we have are pretty basic. Like off the top of my head, you could do this ritual actually just like resets the world. So all technology stops and you're back to like a swords and sorcery kind of game. Let's see. What else you could do? This could absolutely be played in a Call of Cthulhu game.
Of course.
We didn't mention that because, again, Call of Cthulhu, pretty basic on that whole idea. You could have this be something that just really wrecks reality and allows you to do, like, Sundered Skies or a steampunk RPG. You could have this be a ritual that endows people with superpowers and turn it into the origin story for a superhero game.
Absolutely.
There's a lot of things you can do.
I mean, think about it. What would happen if the world's greatest athletes all of a sudden became superheroes?
Yeah.
Because surely they're not going to abuse anything.
No, of course not. Why would you even suggest that, Alan? So let's talk real fast. Let's pick one of these ideas and set up kind of what you would do if you were going to play in it a little bit. Like, if one of these ideas was presented to you.
Okay.
What would you play?
What character would I make?
No, not really a character. Like how would you handle this if someone, like, presented this to you? It's like, hey, I want to do this idea. Like, lay out just like the first few points of the campaign, I guess, is a better way to.
Okay. So let's say, for example, that we go with my Hephaestus waking the Greek gods. So my first big points of the campaign would be establish where this is happening. More than likely, I'd run the game in Mobile simply because I'm the most familiar with it. And I love running modern games in cities that I'm actually familiar with, so I can tell you where things are and, like, you could actually go to that place.
Okay.
Like, that kind of stuff makes me very happy. So that, what effect is this going to have on the players immediately? What effect is this going to have on the players down the road? And what, if anything, can the players do to avoid disaster?
Okay. Sounds good.
Because the question becomes, especially with a game like End of the World, but really with any of these games, if you're playing them more seriously.
Yeah.
There's a really cool game that I also think would work really well for this called 10 Candles. The way it works is you have 10 tea light candles. When all the candles go out, you're dead. But you understand going into the game that your character will die. It is part of the experience of the game. Like, the ending is not happy. So you kind of need to set up whether you want there to be hope, real hope. Do you want the hope to be false? Do you want them to have any sort of way to succeed? But my caveat to that is always, if you are planning to run a game like that, you have to talk to your players first and let them know, hey, I'm thinking about this being a hopeless scenario, because if they start playing a game and you just rob hope from them left and right, it could leave them frustrated if they didn't know what your intentions were. You don't have to tell them, like, your plan or your story, but they do need to be included in that kind of conversation.
Okay. Yeah. I get that. That sounds like a good way to do it.
What about you? How would you handle it?
Oh, let's see. I think my preferred choice would be I think, honestly, I'd want to go further out. So I'd want to go into a kind of a post-apocalyptic, like, I'm going to do my computer idea.
Okay.
So I'm going to shoot this out 10, 15 years into the future. No, maybe 20 years. Shoot this out 20 years after this all happened. The computer went insane, wiped out most of civilization. It's trying to terraform things and maybe doing a very bad job at it. I think you can get a lot of the same kind of imagery that you would get from a Ragnarok adventure to be able to play in The Day After Ragnarok. Or honestly, in any post-apocalyptic game. You get that same kind of... You can have weird terrain from having just, like, spires of, you know, nanoparticles that are just solidified and left there. Mm-hmm. You can have weird enemies. You can have weird creatures that are kind of adapted and kind of corrupted, and you have all that. So I think first up, what I would do is I'd have it be kind of like a Bethesda game starting out, where the party is just, you know, surviving with their little band somewhere kind of off the beaten path. And it gets just demolished because the plot intrudes on their life. Give them, follow a lot of those storytelling tropes. Give them the wise old man who remembers the day it all happened and had been, like, tracking this thing. Like, maybe one of the last keepers of the ritual or something. Mm-hmm. And so your first couple points are, take these people who have grown up in this environment and point them at a potential solution to the problem that is just out of their reach for a little while and then proves not to work. So you just follow those kind of same tropes and you just keep, like, introduce them to new areas. You can take them to, like, the ruins of New York, or, oh, hey, see this massive, just kind of like Dust Bowl. This used to be a thing called an ocean. It's not anymore. It's gone. Down very near the center of it, we'll see a we'll see what's left, but the rest of this is gone. We have to walk across this to this ancient, to where the alien, to where this computer first crash landed here. The Greeks called it Atlantis.
That's really neat.
And that's how I would do it. And like, so it's this trek from wherever you start the game to the Mediterranean, and everything that the computer tries to throw at you, especially as it becomes aware of you.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how I would do it, because that gives you just like infinite possibility of how you can handle one, what players will try to do to your game, and two, this weird world.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how I would run it. Let's see. Is there anything else we need to do with this idea?
I don't think so. I think this is pretty well covered.
All right. So the next time you'll hear from us is going to be on the 24th with another downtime episode. And then in June, we're going to be back with a whole new world for you.
Yep. Very exciting.
Very, very exciting. If you have questions about world building, about GMing, about any of that, hit us up on Twitter. Email us if you use Twitter. Add the hashtag mastering your world, so we'll see that. After we do the June episode, when we get to July and we do our downtime episodes there, one of those will be a big Q&A episode. So hit us up.
We need your questions.
Otherwise, we're going to have to make up questions, and that'll get boring real quick.
Uh-huh.
Also, if you have any ideas for a genre or like a modifier to a genre that you'd like to see us tackle, shoot those ideas at us as well.
And until next time, keep on forging.
Bye.
Bye.
You can find Alan at Alan_Sells on Twitter. You can find Matt at Matt Hoadley on Twitter. You can reach the show at Forging_Worlds or by emailing us, forgingworlds@fifthdraw.com. This show and the rest of the Fifth Draw family of shows can be found at fifthdraw.com. Forging Worlds is presented under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial Sharealike 4.0 International License. For more information, please visit creativecommons.org.